Hello, and welcome to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks, a series of talks by scholars and graduate students on all aspects of film, television, and screen-based media. If you'd like to join our network or find out more about us, you can follow us on Twitter at @SSSNetwork and like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies. You can also visit our website at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.
Well, I've probably explained what this will detail and what the intention is, but it is, as I was just saying, the intention is that I would use this talk as that leads into the SANS conference. And so if you have feedback or anything like that on what I say today or how it's presented, then I'll take that as quite valuable for that conference coming up. Obviously, it details, I will talk about some of the basic ideas of the official COPRO, China, Australia, some of the obstacles, some of the benefits, things like that. I will situate China Light in the periods. I'll talk about the four periods of the relationship between Australian and China co-productions. Talk about China Light, why it was constructed, why it was funded, and some of the processes that they went through over the funding period that they had. And then I'll just come to some conclusions that I've come to. My research has only been 4 months old, so it is still very young and very kind of still in its kind of construction. Hopefully that'll develop in the future. So the key points that I want to talk about is basically providing an update of the relationship between China's film industry and Australian film industry, some of the directions that they have. But it is from an Australian perspective, because I'll be looking at China Light, which is an Australian company. I'll locate China Light within the four periods that I was just talking about. Again, from Australian perspective. And I'll take up the China Light example to illustrate the continuing disconnect between Screen Australia's ambitions for co-production and the actual practical implementation of getting co-productions up and produced and released. So they're the main ideas. This is based on interviews and communications with various bodies and institutions. The majority have been producers, so people who have are working either in China or in Australia. They've been quite free with their responses to me, just about the industry in general, Australia and industry in general, but also about the Australia-China relationship and the co-productions side of it. A lot of varying opinions about the co-production topic from these producers, various reports. And so the future direction of the research will be more in the quantitative exploration of Screen Australia's funding, why they funded it, what were the results of that funding and things like that, the outcomes that we have for the funding. Was it positive, negative, so on? You guys have probably already heard about all of the key terms, so I'll just skip all through this quite quickly. But as just talking, there have been some different changes recently, just recently in the last year, about the SAFT and this and the Dragon, that's now become part of the publicity department, which was formerly the propaganda department. So that's all been restructured, I guess. So it's something that filmmakers, producers need to be cognizant of. The CFCC, I'll get to just now. So the treaty, and just talking generally, is just basically an agreement. And the agreement is to focus on the outputs, the results of the creative and the financial side of it. With the Chinese and the Australian side of it, there is different motivations and different emphasis on it. And I'll get to that. But as a lead-in, the Chinese see and have spoken quite clearly about their intention to drive and strengthen the creative side of it, while the Australian side is very much centered on financial results that they get from this relationship. So it's a little bit different that they that the two sides in the agreement come at it from different ways. So that's essentially it. They come together and they maximize their resources for these two basic and broad ideas. And so they're overseen by the Australian side, Screen Australia, they're the competent authority. And on the Chinese side, got two, the CFCC and the Publicity Department, Department of Publicity, and they oversee it. I'm less adept at talking about the CFCC and the Publicity Department of Publicity. It's still a little bit complicated for me at this point. And only knowing a little bit of Putonghua, it's even more complicated. So I'm just trying to build those relationships as I go. But essentially, it's a two-stage process. There's a provisional one, and then there's a final one. And that determines, linking back, talking about the Saft and the Dragon, the final one, that's what we're talking about, that they need to get the approval on both sides. So the obstacles are quite obvious. Language barriers, there's time zones differences. Not too bad in terms of Australia and China, but there are that is an obstacle for production to talk to each other on both sides. There's different cultural approaches to filmmaking, different expectations, marketing, and legal systems, which is a massive barrier that the producers come across, and quite often tell you quite forwardly about. And then there's a requirement to meet the three parties. Overheads and company fees, restrictions on casting and crewing, and vulnerable via shared production. So these things can all get, the production can get exploded at any point because of these various obstacles. And we see that, and when you're looking through what has happened in the last 10 years with the treaty, which was enacted in 2008, signed in 2006, that a number of productions stalled and then ultimately got shelved because of whatever the various obstacles that they couldn't overcome. The benefits, of course, thinking back to the creative and the financial points of it, is that they can pull the resources together in terms of finances. They can qualify to get into the various markets. It's soft money funding, particularly in terms of Australia. Not so much in terms of, from what I understand, the Chinese side of it, which is a little bit difficult to track and trace where the funding comes from. But ultimately, from what I gather, it's from private sources that may or may not have links to the government. So the funding is robust. And so the filmmakers and the producers can source this kind of funding, and it enables them to produce these films, something that they couldn't, a film that they potentially couldn't do just in Australia. So that's a significant benefit for someone shooting above that small to medium range that Australia tends to produce, to something along the lines of 20 million, 30 million, 40 million. The biggest one so far is 30 million that has actually come about from the co-production. And that's something that we don't often see in Australia if you're not Baz Luhrmann or producing a Mad Max or something like that. And it's exempt from the foreign film quota. I'll touch on that quickly, but you've I presume you've heard about it a lot. So from the Chinese side, and you might have some ideas about this, that the two main themes that I see coming through from the literature is that China is opening up their industry to production, really ramping it up in the last 20 years, production and competition. And we see that come through in terms of the global box office that China has taken, which is now up to around 20% of the global box office. Huge numbers. And I think that this is all kind of like China copro or China industry bingo that you can probably tick off, right? So the screens, we were talking just before, Ben, about the cinema screens. So the majority of these, the 50,000 that they've put in just recently, since 2007, they're all 3D capable screens. So they're all digital, but digital screens, you know, so that's just a massive increase. And the scope and scale of it is just amazing. And then you have the ticket sales. So that's why you hear so much about it in terms of US market. The West is so interested in China. There's so much money. It's bonkers. And so that's one. On the one side, you see production getting taken up, but you also have the government kind of controlling it and maintaining it, this production, curating it, if you like, in particular ways. And so you have the film quota, 34 films, 20 conventional and 14 special format films. Although sometimes that quota is a little bit loose, depending on the circumstances that comes about from the CFCC and the various departments. So it can be changed. And so I think that is one thing that just 4 months in China that I've learned, is that there are rules and then you can do something about them. Like, it's not strict at all in that way. So there's the famous import film quota for foreign films that Chinese control. There is also censorship, of course, which is a very popular topic for people to talk about. And that's because you have things like big blockbusters getting rejected entirely, or blockbusters like Logan getting things cut out of it. I think Logan may have been 14 minutes. You have Fantastic Beasts. Even though that these films represent some of the subjects that are taboo in the industry. So Fantastic Beasts would be stories about magic and things like that. Alien, horror. One of the things from Alien was that in the last quarter of the film, you hardly saw the actual monster. Because only 6 minutes was cut out of it, but that 6 minutes was very heavily weighted towards the actual monster. And then Ghostbusters was cut altogether. It didn't get its, even though they applied. Now, the other lever that they have to maintain and curate their industry is the various quotas or co-productions and the flat fee. So Bait 3D was a flat fee because it was the various production stream that they had coming up at the end, and China adding a few little bits and pieces to it. So these are the main themes. So opening up, producing, elevating the production in massive numbers, and then, sorry, yes.
Could you explain a bit further about the financial side?
Sure.
Using Bait 3D as an example.
Okay, so Bait 3D was produced in collaboration on the Australian side and then a Singapore company, and that was a co-production. Then a Chinese company came in to make it a Chinese GoPro. But at that stage, the film had already finished and been completed. And so the ArcLight, the company, negotiated a fixed price, which they came to really regret which means the fixed flat fee meant that they just got their lump sum at the beginning, and so they got a whatever standard amount that was from the Chinese side of it to exhibit it. But because Bait3D was quite a success in China, what they could have got if they negotiated a different price, something percentage-wise, rather than a flat fee, they would have got a lot more. So that's what the flat fee means. The quota means that if you're listed as a quota film, you get 25% of the revenue in China. So that's much better than the flat fee that they negotiated. An official co-production, 43%, they would have got. So they would have got a significant amount for Bait3D if they didn't negotiate.
So actually the quota film received less revenue than co-production?
Yes, and that is because the quota films are just foreign films. The co-productions are considered Chinese, and so they get a little bit more, well, significantly more. And that's the difference. They can negotiate it outside of the CFC or Department of Publicity, flat fee. They can be a quota, and so they have to get they have to get part of the 34, which is very heavily contested. A lot of competition there, because you're going up against Alien, Fantastic Beasts, and things like that. So Australians are really pushed out of that element. We have to do the co-production or the flat fee. But financially, if you can do the co-production side of it, 43% of the revenue in China, it's significantly better if your film is good. Does that explain? Yeah? Great. So that's there. Oh, the industry forecast. Okay, so this is quickly. I'll just try and jet through this. Urbanization in China is increasing significantly, 3% year-on-year growth, which is amazing. That means that people in the cities will seek entertainment. The cinema is one of those avenues for that entertainment to be taken up. And so there is a growing demand for cultural products, like cinema productions and things like that. And so we're likely to see an increase. Those screens that they're putting in are likely to get used quite well. Intellectual property protection policies, this is something that President Xi has talked about, that he is going to, well, his government is going to protect and increase the intellectual property protection. And so kind of standardize the industry in a way to make more secure for people producing content, that they can get their money back if they put in the effort in. And this is something he talked about here with Get Out policy, enlargening large-scale expansion of market access. So there's a sharing. But this is also something that he said in, I think it was 2016, 2017? Yes. And so there has been different particular topics and discussions with US, of course. And so that the expansion of market access is still in flux, just like anything. Diversification of China, various conglomerates, Disney models. So you see a lot of expansion of the conglomerates in line with that horizontal and vertical production that you see Disney have. Disney, of course, is in China. Industry production targeting mid and lower tier cities. I think this is a particularly interesting part of where the Chinese industry is going, that, and something particularly for Australia to target is the industry, the mid and lower tier cities. So you have, and talking about tiers, you have the big cities. Do I need to explain what the tier system is in China? Yeah? Okay, so you have the ginormous cities like Beijing and Shanghai and Guangzhou and things like that. And then you have a series of smaller and smaller cities. And the lower tier ones really don't get much of an inlook, even though the city that I'm in, which is considered the lowest tier, a county or a small town, it's still 1.4 million people. So it's significant that you can get that target audience. You can engage them, the Australian industry can do that and then maximize their audience tenfold. So this is what I was talking about before in terms of the motivation for China to get involved with co-productions. Domestic film influence and strengthening their techniques and production values. And then you have challenging outside foreign influences that they can strengthen their industry and at the same time kind of stave off some of the other industries involved. This is something Mark Lazarus, who is currently at Sydney Films, was talking about, that the main emphasis that he sees that China is interested in is that it's not so much emphasizing the financial side, but mostly concerned with the cultural points. Finances in an industry that's putting in 50,000 screens over a short period isn't as much interested in the financial side of it as they are in the cultural side of it. I found that particularly interesting. And we were just saying that this is his argument is that trying to make it a more international film industry, the Chinese industry. They're looking outward, the filmmakers.
But it's very challenging.
Very challenging, yeah. And this is what I just say. This is a key distinction between our relationship to US and our relationship to China, is that because the emphasis is on cultural points, it's not so significant when the Australian industry suffers from a higher dollar. I think if the dollar hits around 70 cents, US isn't interested in coming to Australia. The productions dry up. But anything over that, they don't come. Anything below it, then they'll come to us. And you see a lot more US productions. But China, we don't see that trend happening. And so we can have a high dollar and we still can progress with these co-productions, which is an interesting point. Another point is that China needs the Western to engage an international audience. It needs to have particular values, technical values. And to gain that experience, they can come to Australia. This is a filmmaker expressing these views. And so that is one idea, that Australia is potentially significant in terms of, because we do have lots of Hollywood production, technical side of it, that they can then use us as a means of engaging that international audience. And so the idea being that there are other motivations to engage Australia, the relationship between China and Australia, other than creative, broad creative ideas of creating these productions, that there are institutional and industrial reasons for engaging Australia. He's using fairly blunt and colloquial language here, but essentially what he's saying is that Chinese filmmakers can engage Australian filmmakers, and those ideas and skills in how to make and engage an international audience can be exchanged in this relationship. I should have said before that Australia is one of the few countries in the world to have a treaty with China. America does not have a treaty with China for film industry. That's why they go through the quota you'll see most often, the 34 films. They won't make as many co-productions. And so there is not that relationship between China and America that you see formed that China and Australia has. They don't have an official relationship in the same way that we do. And so if China is to engage that international audience, so North America and Europe in particular, what Difram is saying here is that China can then source those skills and those practices to engage those audiences via Australia, by the relationship that they already have. So having that in mind, the motivations for a Screen Australia are different. And some of the things that I've already kind of outlined is that the Screen Australia's quite openly discussed that they want to nurture the creative and technical expertise of the industry, which they do quite well. They also, more sustainable industry, better business, bigger and better business, bigger audiences and things like that. And that these are the four core things that Screen Australia does, and the two on the left are the ones that they really connects with the co-production side of it. Grow the demand for Australian content, which definitely the co-production does, because we get to engage that Chinese audience, or an easier pathway into that marketplace, at least. And then to increase the quality and variety and the ambition of the productions. And so by sourcing various different funding from China, you get to increase the budgets and get to increase the ambition of the projects as well. So that they're the two things, the core ideas for Screen Australia that they have outlined, that really, to me, link to co-productions, are important for it. Now, these quotes are essentially supporting the idea that business is a significant factor for Australia. So the motivations are different. But ultimately, what we see is that on the China side, co-productions represent quite a significantly small part of their industry. And so you have, even though you have these amazing numbers of films getting made, it only ultimately comes down to 0.06% of the production that Australia and China co-productions represent. And it is the same for Australia. I'll just scoot through, but it's 1.6%. We produce less films, so the ratios are a little bit higher, but essentially it's the same kind of, demonstrates the same kind of thing. And what we see here, so this will probably help you. These are the Australian films that we've seen produced. So four we have there that have been released, Children of the Silk Road, Bait 3D. Then we have a series of films that were slated, got fair way through their production process or pre-production process, and then they were shelved for various reasons. I won't go into the various reasons why they were shelved, because I'll focus on China Light. And so we come to 2018. Yeah. So we have a lull in the middle, 2018. We have a series of films, Guardians of the Tomb, I was telling you about. At Last hasn't been released yet, but is due to be released soon, very soon, in the next 2 months or so. That the Whistleblower is the big one that Australian and China, or Australia in particular, is hoping that is a big success.
So they've got to use that to promote the location.
Yeah, yeah. And it's got some big names.
Yes.
The producer behind it is significant. And so these are ones slated to be produced. And so we have this significant uplift of productions, which may or may not come about, but we are hoping that in the Australian co-production industry, that these do have, these are very varied titles.
Of course. I'm just going to get something slight. The titles there, Trip to Australia, Lost in Australia.
Yes.
I mean, you were talking about the kind of different approaches or the different reasons that for China has for co-producing these films. Right.
And these titles might change. You see titles change quite often. But yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if there's some kind of money coming from Australian tourism?
I would absolutely think that
this
is
a major. You're right. Because China doesn't see Australia as a producing partner or
yeah.
So Australia tries to market itself as
a
beautiful country.
The place to
yeah.
The holidays.
I think that's why you can see it reflected on the
time. Yeah. You see a lot of beaches in the advertising. Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, that there are layers to the productions that you see. And so The Whistleblower and At Last are quite drama-oriented productions. There's big hope that they will break through into various markets, not just Australia and China, but also America and Europe and things like that. Whereas you probably see a trip to Australia and think that it has a fairly small release. If it actually is released theatrical at all, it might just go to VOD or something like that. Hulu, Netflix, whatever it is. So I'll carry on. So try to get to China Light. But the four basic phases, you can kind of see it in that slide already, is that you have the initial treaty where it's positive and it's full of potential and things are getting made. Then you have a drop-off where various industrial problems or differences occur, where a CEO comes in and changes the direction of the company, and it means that has wider implications for the production. Then you have a bottoming out, and then a return to the pre-slump, so minor productions coming through, minor numbers I mean, but quite significant productions. And then hopefully you saw that huge slate, so we get quite a number of productions getting made. We'll skip through this. So this is just an illustration of that up and down. And you see China Light coming in the bottom, bottoming out. So you see that's where we can situate and think about China Light coming in. So at its lowest ebb, really, the production from the Australian perspective, it was the lowest. I was just going to skip through this because, it's interesting. We're probably talking a lot. Well, I'll skip through it really quickly. Bait 3D was a hit. It was an ArcLight film that manifested in the Stone Forest and other productions getting picked up for ArcLight. So that's put in development, but the Stone Forest is shelved for various reasons. No Chinese partner was found, and so they couldn't go forward with the co-production, the official co-production. So they had this story, they had the script, this development, but they couldn't find the other side of the partnership to form it a co-production. And having having experienced the flat fee experience with Bait 3D, they wanted to pursue the co-production side and see if they could get the money back. And Deep Water was shelved because of the crash, because it related to an airplane. Nest, which was later titled Guardians of the Tomb, is put in development. They found a partnership this time with Grand Canal, which meant that Guardians of the Tomb could be released. And then after that, they were awarded the enterprise program funding for China Light to set up this a subsidiary of ArcLight to find other productions for co-production. And Gary Hamilton, which is the name of the ArcLight managing director, he really was involved in all this. He was involved in getting the funding for China Light. You see, it was $300,000 from Screen Australia. Its goals were basically identify the talent, develop it through various means, and I'll get to the specifics of that in a second. Workshops, it was basically to help shape it, so to identify the productions, develop them with the idea of them being a co-production, an official co-production, so the cultural sensitivities and things like that, to make sure that the production would get the dragon in the end. Soft approval. So those two things. And the aim was to get three per year. So China Light was an ongoing, the idea of it was that it would be an ongoing subsidiary. However, what we found is that China Light didn't get continued funding, and ArcLight had its focus on different things, and so it didn't actually progress beyond the Screen Australia funding. But the idea was that they would use Screen Australia, ArcLight would use Screen Australia to find different and more interesting productions. So things like The Whistleblower and At Last that would present a different side of China or a different side of Australia, whatever it is, that they would go around those problems that they've had in the past. So the process was that they would get 100 applications, story applications, ideas, and then through various processes of interviewing the people, looking at their, investigating their body of work and things like that, they would select three productions. And then they would then workshop those through general discussions or talking about what the restrictions on the productions might be, getting a filmmaker to come in and talk to them about the processes that he faced and what the successful processes that he came to. And then also they had a person from China come in a film industry person from China, and then they could discuss what they needed to do to progress. But the result is that so far none of the ideas that they workshopped and developed and identified progressed to production, and the funding ran out in 2017. So China Light, it started, they identified productions through their processes, and then nothing we haven't found yet. It doesn't mean that those ideas and those script ideas haven't continued to be developed, but nothing has been released. If you think back to what I was just saying a little while ago in terms of what I can list, no producer has listed any of the China Light productions. So that's all we can go on at the moment. So it's a little bit difficult. No, China Light is finished. It's ended. Arc Light is still there. Eastern Light is still there. Dark Light is still a subsidiary, and that's still there. Yeah, it's an enterprise program that they give money to establish and create the production, the development house, the company. That's like a Kickstarter, if you like. However, that we don't know how much money that Arc Light put into China Light as well. So there could be another bundle of cash that also combined with Screen Australia's. Anyway, that ended. And so what we have is nothing concrete. However, but ArcLight do say that they have several co-productions in the works, but they haven't actually announced what those titles are or anything like that. And so you can draw your quite clear conclusions from this, that it's that the what we were saying before, that the institutional, the Australian screen industry and Screen Australia, that co-productions are still an aspiration for, that they want to engage the Chinese industry, and we want to learn from the Chinese industry as much as they want to learn from us, and we want to engage their market. But at the present time, that is still an aspiration for it at all. And it's still, we can say that China Light, because it didn't produce anything, we can say that it represents that particular lull in the co-production slates. And it's a little bit hard to judge what the outcomes or the successes were. The fact that they got money from Screen Australia is a particular success. The fact that they developed ideas to a various point could be considered a success as well. However, we don't have anything, no results, productions. And that's a fairly common thing, as we saw with the co-productions before. It doesn't mean that those ideas, Sydney Films could pick one up. Who knows? So it's still aspirational, I think, on both sides. The constants, the conclusions that I can make, is that China will increase their market access. Screen Australia will incentivize co-productions continuing forward with the enterprise program, the fact that we can offer the production offset and so on, and various development. Co-production decline and creation of China Light coincides with a general lull overall in the Australian production, Australian industry at that time. So even though it appears that co-production and China Light were could be considered failures. There was an overall lull in the Australian production at that time. More generally, I think this is just a broad point that it's interesting that no animations have been made. I think in terms of the quota, Disney will have a number of films in the quota, probably a budgetary issue too. But yeah, I still think it's interesting that we haven't done one. Yeah. So that concludes it.
Thanks for sticking around.
Okay, so I thought I really enjoyed Dave's presentation. I thought something I did for 5 years, he did in 4 months. That's amazing. I just want to tell you a little bit of my research so that you know what perspective my questions are from. Yeah. So I look at co-productions as well, but I look at the policies. I also look at the audience reception. So I study Chinese audience reception on these co-productions. So I actually, your presentation is a lot more detailed than mine when it comes to policies and politics. There's just one thing that when I'm talking about official co-productions in China is one thing that I've struggled with. It took me a few years to wrap my head around it because, as we know, as for my presentation as well, an official co-production, when is it an official co-production, when it's not? And if you realize China actually removes official co-production from the narrative, so instead of calling it official co-production, they call it a joint production.
Yeah.
So only the foreigner will, like, so in this respect, the Australian will call it an official co-production because the treaty is signed, whereas in China, they remove the term official co-production and call it joint production. So even if a film was made in the official co-production, it might not receive joint production, which means it's not seen as a domestic product. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, an American film doesn't have a treaty with China because of Donald Trump and all this kind of nonsense and a free trade agreement. Yes, now there's a big conflict between China and Donald Trump, which is why a lot of films, there's a lot of delay in films and things like that. But so because Australia doesn't have a co-production agreement with China, they do have joint productions, which means, for example, Kung Fu Panda 3 is a domestic film in China. Mm. What are your thoughts about that? Do you find that, do you think it's conflicting, or like, do you think it actually helps the industry, or do you think China is trying to set its own rules for the future?
It's totally their own rules, right? Like, but that's okay. I think we set our own rules, and they, even though they don't have official relationships with America, and they do for us, then they're welcome to make productions with China. I mean, with the US.
Yeah,
but it means it's super complicated. Looking at it, and you have like joint productions and official co-productions, and what the nomenclature represents, like what that means. It's very difficult to like navigate your way through all that stuff.
Mm.
But yeah, absolutely, they should. Well, they should partnership with whoever they want.
Yeah.
But the Trump thing is interesting how that has. So you've seen a decrease in the number of, talking about the Disney model, business model, we've seen a number of Chinese businesses not progress and get the American companies, or maybe an Australian company, maybe ArcLight or someone like that, that's been reined in a bit recently. So that's had different like outcomes, not necessarily on the film front. I don't know. Has it?
So there was a recent announcement that was made by the Chinese president that he wants Chinese companies to stop private financial acquisition and investment in foreign companies, especially in film companies in Hollywood, which is what you were just saying. From production front, I don't think there is much of a difference because it's all
films
behind the scenes.
Back,
yeah,
regardless. Yeah.
Exactly. And also, if let's say we are talking about post-production aspect, there's not much of a difference because they're not publicly recognized.
Mm.
So if you talk about VFX and all that, like if you look at Korea, you know, Korea and China,
right,
before the new president, there was a conflict.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
No,
so,
sorry.
Oh, so no. So Korea and America had good relations. So they want to put a missile system in Korea to aim at North Korea. It's called TAD.
Right. Yep.
And China was not happy about that because if let's say they shoot a missile it went into China. So what the Chinese government did was they put a ban in all Korean entertainment products. You know, K-pop and Korean
wave.
Yeah. So a lot of production that was actually stated to be released was removed, like what you listed up there. So it's similar with America, but not that extreme. Because I don't think it's that extreme, because America makes big bucks in China, but they delay the productions or they remove production suddenly. But if they know that the production made a lot of money in America, they would probably approve it, but 2-3 months later.
Well, the AMCO, that production company, they told me that they weren't quite. No, was it AMCO? I think it was AMCO. That they weren't quite happy with that the standardization of the Chinese film industry, and that they were maybe pulling out of China and putting it into America because of that flakiness that sometimes happens.
Like, yeah.
We just had, what's the Li Bingbing film with Bruce Willis?
Fan Bingbing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it got pulled out because she didn't pay tax.
Because she didn't pay tax. That film just ends
because of a personal choice. Someone's personal choice.
That goes back ages and ages. So that standard.
Yeah. So for those who didn't know, there was this blockbuster that was going to be released with Bruce Willis and a very famous Chinese actress called Fan Bingbing. So she got into a series of controversies this year because she didn't pay tax. She had a secret contract which didn't reflect her actual salary. So she actually did not pay her actual tax. So the Chinese government was trying to make an example of her. So she went into hiding. Anyways, blah, blah. When her film was supposed to be released in November, got taken out from official release, and the company, production company, was hoping that it would make most of its budget in China. But now it's been removed from the cinema, so just because of one person's
decision.
Was
that a joint production or was that a quota?
I actually don't know about that. But if it's Fan Bingbing on it, it could be either assisted or joint production. So assisted it... Okay, this is my next question. Like, because we are so blurred about whether it's a joint production or assisted production, you don't really know until you actually work for a company or you can get first-hand view, because you can't... Doing a Google search, you're not going to find anything. Do you think about the concept of guanxi? So guanxi is the idea of networking in China. So networking in China is a very big deal, and in China they call it guanxi. So basically on who you know, if you know someone, you're more likely to get your film released. Whereas if you don't have any context, you might be a very, your film might be an amazing film, but it won't get released because you don't know the right people. So do you think you'll be discussing about that to try to identify what films are released and not? Because what I found is that in my research, that if I identify who the stakeholders are, it kind of gives me a reason why a film is released or not.
Yeah.
Do you think you will discuss about that or in further research?
I guess so. That though, you hear examples told to you, talking to the producers of these films, that they feel, whether or not it's true, that it's the Chinese producers, if they get a white guy who's got credits to his name walks into a room, it's more impressive. That's the impression that they get, whether or not that's actually true. But you do hear stories about that happening. Whether or not it's not something that I've thought about too much, that if I find whatever production companies, then that opens doors. Is that what you've found in your experience?
Yeah, because just Bait 3D actually got me interested in guanxi. I actually was like you. I just thought that it's a sociological concept, media studies, production studies, it might not be very helpful. But then when you look at Bait 3D, just Mark saying that his wife's contacts gave him money and gave him the opportunity to release in China actually made me try to investigate further.
Right.
So if you look at Looper, Iron Man 3, they have the same release dates as in China and internationally. Because the guy who brought the film into China, he's an American dude, but he lived in China for a long time and he's very strong ties with the government. He used to work for a marketing company. And so he was the one who brought the film in and managed to get the same release date. So it makes me question whether Huanxi plays an important role, which is why probably Mark, with the Sydney Films, why is he so confident in making co-productions? I mean, it's just a thought.
I think Mark is connected to these films, but I think this is Wainan. We were just talking about Wainan Song, who's the head of Sydney Films. I think this is, it's probably his network that has kind of like got that 400 million and got these, and Mark probably got these titles and the ideas underway. But yeah, I can see what you mean with networking. I've only been there for 4 months, but I often wonder with just in my institution how that relationship with Duke on one side and Wuhan on the other side, and how that all came about, and the relationship with the institution to the local government, as well as Jiangsu government and broader and broader. Talking about Trump, there's got to be some kind of tension between having Duke engaged.
In China.
But that's a different story. But obviously there's some kind of networking going on. I wouldn't be surprised, but
I'm
not privy to it.
I mean, it's something that is not a definite answer. But it's just something that makes me wonder.
Get evidence.
Yeah, it's just something that makes me wonder just based on conversations and
interviews. Yeah, yeah.
And even sometimes, because I do audience research, the audience themselves actually use that word
to
say, how is this film released?
All right.
Especially Children of the Silk Road.
Right. Oh, really? You found... I wondered, I mean, I think it happens in Australia too, because we're such a small industry that if you know one name, the door's open.
Yeah.
And everything like that. Like, if you've got a connection with Screen Australia or you have a previous relationship with them, then I think... especially in terms of China Light, they proved, I guess, with Bait and then a series of productions that didn't work, and then they did Guardians or Nest. So they got money that way. But it's who you know in Australia too.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Some question. One question. What if the China Light project is quite interesting. I wonder from your research whether you found some insights, you know, why, so, you know, 300,000 and maybe more from ArtRide has been put into this initiative, and three projects out of 100 of applications being selected and workshopped on scripts and ideas, and you know, why it didn't, you know, come into fruition, you know, didn't become a production project, because I imagine the fact that Screen Australia put $300,000, the idea is to get to fuel co-production out of it. And what happened in the process, you know, or failed to happen?
Well, that's a very good question, and people answered it, but they didn't allow me to to tell you.
Oh.
So it's because it's very delicate, industry contacts and things like that.
That's the biggest hurdle of our research, I think, of knowing it in our head and not being able to say it published.
Off the record.
Off the record.
Yeah, no, I have the same problems as you. It's like trying to think, how can I say this without implicating?
But it's also, you know, you see the ones in red. It happens a lot that things don't work out, especially I think when dealing with two. It happens more when it's two in the treaty, when you have to navigate three bodies, different time zones, different languages, and things like that. I think.
Just going to ask on that, just because of the coincidence of times, there was nothing.
It's
to
weird,
do,
isn't it?
No, the Liberal government coming in 2013.
I haven't.
Can I answer your question?
Oh, yeah, go for it.
Asian Century Paper was released around that time, where the government was trying to Australian government was
that's
trying
clever.
To
yeah, good one.
Go into Asia, being Asia focused and all that, and then after that, we all know it changed.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. I just thought that it seemed to be the timing was perfect. It's like, yeah. We're not, Screen Australia is government funded. We're not, we want to be behind this, but we can't necessarily be fully behind this because the government's there looking at us and what we're doing.
Yeah.
And then if they've, oh, what's the time zone issue? Oh, there's this issue. Oh, well, these all just sort of.
You're exactly right. Like, that's why official co-productions, one of the biggest thing is, it's politics. It's just politics. It's the politics agreement. It's everything. It's politics.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with the film content. It's
politics.
You're
mentioning Trump, and I was thinking, well, we've had our own version of that in Australia with Abbott. The next one did. So we're just...
What do you mean, had?
Well, we still have. I know. Well, okay. We were
Scott
still in.
Scott Morris.
But yeah.
So you think that the 2013 report was...
I think it's a reflection of the Asian century, like where they were heading towards, where they were planning to head towards, and then it got shelved.
Right. So the causal response, so explain it to me a little bit. If these didn't succeed, you think it's a factor?
I think, yes. Just my opinion. I don't have evidence because I actually...
I'll look into it.
To be honest, I did not look beyond... that because everything that I was waiting to come out did not come out, so I just gave up and moved on. And then everything came out in 2018. It's too late. That's this year. But I feel, in my opinion, the Asian Century paper got shelved during that period of time when there was a change of party in the Australian government.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at when the treaty was signed, it was when Australia was heading towards going to the Asian market and to promote Asia in Australia with Kevin Rudd. So it happened during Kevin Rudd, John Howard, Kevin Rudd, yeah. And then after that, Asian Century paper got shelved, and I think that's when, even just in general, in Australia in general, just not just in film business, but in all trade, they kind of became this anti-immigration, anti...
Well, they're just trying to hide, they still have all those, obviously, all the stuff in China, but they're just trying to hide it. Pretend it's not happening, they just code it up, yeah.
It's not
in the public eye as much.
Oh, that's interesting.
Another thing you might want to look at is also China also did not have a very good relationship with Australia in the previous years.
Did that?
Prior in to trade. 2008?
No, between 2012 and 2018, there were some trade issues which saw a decreased number of international students in Australia as well. So that could be something, I don't know. To be honest, I've not... Research into that area because there's too many gray areas. But you can look at the trade relations between Australia and China during this period of time because Chinese international students, the numbers also dropped in that period too. So could it be that there was government pressure on Australian agreements? I don't know.
Which is interesting because that's also when it dropped for Europe because Europe was starting to clamp down on international students as well.
But so, the disagreement wasn't just on international students. It was something to do with a disagreement between both countries in trade. And then it just affected other industries as well. So to be honest, I did not look deeper into this. I knew about it and then I thought the timing was too coincidental.
Well, like you were saying, it's very peculiar to see red.
And obviously we're still in it, and he was saying that there's productions happening and stuff, but then,
they do say that some of them didn't find partners, and then you have weird coincidences with air crashes, and so...
The air crash one was for real though. That was because of the air crash.
Oh, it's a coincidence.
It was a coincidence.
In production.
But that was a legit reason because there was a lot of backlash.
No, but they have other reasons for being shelved.
Can I give you an example why I thought of that?
Sure.
What I thought of this. So the reason why I've been thinking about these political issues is. I'll go back to Korea again, you know how that issue is. So my friend, he's a director, Korean director, and he finished making a film. And so then they submitted his film for censorship. It was an official co-production, got joint production, and it got rejected and rejected and rejected. But the reasons that they would give was quite obscure reasons why the film got rejected. His was not the only film, there were other films as well. And then it just got me thinking, could it be because of the political relationship, but they can't say, we can't show your film because of these political tensions, but we will find fault in these films.
Right.
So could it be that reason, you know, maybe you can structure your interview questions in a way where you can ask, like, have they gone through, because they were already produced, so they already filmed. Could it be because they tried to get it past censorship and it did not go past, or and then they covered it?
Yeah, that's what that three levers thing, they, and I'm no expert, but it does seem that they can pull one lever to slow it and then another one to slow it even more and, you know, grind it to a halt.
What levers are you talking about? The screen?
The film quota, the censorship, and the various funding strategies. So flat fee and things like that.
Based on their mood.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Like more than I thought moving to China, that would be the case. I got very stressed about various things, and then it came to it, and it didn't even appear on the radar. So it's very different.
I think that the film, whether a co-production film is get a government approval, probably has more to do with the political situation and trends within China than the diplomatic trade relations with a particular country, because Chinese film, local films, face similar censorship as well.
Hmm. And it particularly depends on ghost stories.
Ghost stories. And they are also, if you look at the history of Chinese cinema, you see, you know, different films get censored and chopped, and even brilliant, you know, masterpieces, and they have faced different fates. And the Chinese filmmakers have to be extremely resilient if they can, you know, want their film to get passed. And often you submit one version and they will come back and with, demands to change this and that, and you submit another version, further demands, and if you can't go through that process, and you can still at any time, particularly if the films, there are some clear taboo areas and political issues and historical issues, and if you touch that, it takes enormous courage and resilience to carry the whole thing through, because you could be stopped at any stage.
Well, like Kai's friend from South Korea.
Yeah, that's why I think you should do at Guangxi.
Oh, yeah?
Because just in reflection, if I made a comparison, The Mermaid, which is a Hong Kong, China co-production, and the director has very close ties with the Communist Party, he has similar themes in his film and it got passed. So I'm thinking that it could be... I mean, for me, I found
Stephen
it helpful
Chow
to...
is connected to the Communist Party.
Yes,
yeah,
so
is he's
in the Guangdong... something committee, so he's actually in the celebrity committee that actually helped advise the Communist Party with publicity and stuff like that. So I think, I don't know, I found it useful for me to look at Guangxi when I was looking at co-productions, but then again, I look at more than this. I look beyond Australia. I don't know, because I don't know if you're familiar with the term junior partner. So Australia's given a term as a junior partner, where the idea is that Australia needs more of China than China needs of Australia. So maybe, you know, the same ideas don't play here, but that might be something you want to think about moving forward, just to help you explain the holes, the gray areas.
Yeah, good.
I think it's just a question, because I've got no idea. What is the thing about the ghost stories?
I'm not an expert, but ghost stories have particular resonance with traditional cultural groups in China that don't necessarily jibe with the communist, the CCP. And
so he's non-religious.
Yeah, and so they don't particularly like those kind of stories because it's not within the purview of the party, what they want, the direction.
But this is changing.
I only did a tiny little bit of Mandarin at school, but one of those things that he'd show me was this weird vampire film from China. That doesn't like go.
But this is, but this
but
is
that was, that's what I was wondering. I was like, oh, okay, that's the same for that because I only have such a small amount of knowledge. That's why.
But this is changing, and I think it's dependent on Guanxi again.
Yeah.
Because there's this Korean film called Bunshi Saba, and then it was remade in China by the same director.
I was thinking that about Korean as well. Yeah.
And it was shown in Chinese cinema. His Chinese remake was shown in Chinese cinema, and it's about supernatural things. So I think that's where Guanxi plays a role, because they know that that film was a Korean way film. It worked. I don't know. I don't have the answer. I don't think any of us have the answer, but I'm thinking, could that be an explanation?
But then you also get like Fantastic Beasts, and that's got ghosts in it, right?
It's by fantasy, though.
Thrillers with ghosts in it as well. But I think it's dangerous to generalize.
Especially in Chinese case.
And Guanxi can be easily overplayed. If you look at different, you can. It's better to base your research on facts. You know what have been released, co-productions and local films, what has been approved, what has been knocked back, at what historical period.
You can get the empirical the interviews. People did mention, not straightforward,
but
and I
between the lines.
Yeah, I wasn't. Super listening for it, but people did talk about just relationships,
because
and that's sorry, that was one of the when China Light got someone from the Chinese film industry, they didn't, it was a private in company that this person was from, but quite clearly it was from SAFT or CFCC. I think it had a lot to do with how to navigate and build that network and build the relationships in China. So I think people know about it and discuss it quite openly, but never go on the record about it.
There are two sides here. One side is Guanxi. Guanxi opens doors and people can talk more openly and more casually and tell you more. That's one side. But there are also some taboos that you're supposed to know, and that knowledge needs to be built as well. But even if you have the highest Guanxi, you can't cross those lines. So this is what so you need to know both sides.
So just to get that right, there's taboos, the cultural taboos, or
political taboos always come first. Political, cultural, social, and they changes over time.
Uh-huh.
Depends on the different phase, different particularly when the leadership changes, when the political trends changes, etc.
Right.
So that's one side. The other side is Guanxi. Yes, Guanxi. If you don't have Guanxi, you don't know where the doors are. You don't know the but Guanxi. Ultimately, if you don't have a sense of what are the taboos, you don't know the boundaries, even the highest level of Guanxi can't get you, carry you across the line.
I think I understand what you mean.
I thought another thing that could be interesting is that it's something I found for Children of the Silk Road is the title.
All right, yeah.
Because initially it was Children of the Huangshi, and then they changed it to Children of the Silk Road because they felt they want to promote it to the Western audience as well. They want to show that they're internationalized themselves. So it might be interesting to look at the titles. Another thing as well, the location of where things were shot.
Right.
Because
Mark talked about that. It was being very important.
Because
cameras have to roll.
Because sometimes, if let's say they didn't meet the percentage, because you have to debate between joint productions and official co-productions, where joint productions doesn't have that percentage of where the film should be. So basically, official co-productions have the agreement that if, let's say, however X amount of financial input you have, that film must be filmed in that country.
Mm-hmm.
So at some times where, let's say, one country has more financial investment than the other, but then let's say, for example, Children of the Huangshi is set in China, but majority of the funding came from Australia. So what they did was they reconstructed a warehouse in Melbourne to look like China. So,
it's 80-20.
It was
80-20,
yeah. So they filmed too much in China, so they need to make it back. So they actually converted a warehouse, or it was just a space in Melbourne to look like China. So it could be interesting to look at the location as well. just to...
I think that, yeah, that,
same with Bait.
When the, some of the producers were talking about that ratio,
yeah.
So if Chinese companies put more money in than Australia, then their expectation is that they have bigger say, of course. And so part of that, so they would shoot more in China or whatever they choose, which is generally shoot more in China. And so that ratios for a particular film.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a great quantitative kind of like measure of how the creative approaches shaped by the financial.
Yeah, exactly. Even Bait, it was filmed mostly in Gold Coast and then China put in a few million dollars and suddenly they have to shoot a Beijing club scene.
Yeah. Which when you were telling me about,
I'll send you the link to the YouTube clip. It's all on YouTube, the deleted scenes. And so they actually filmed the entire scene and then they showed a few seconds in the Chinese version and they actually filmed 10 minutes. A few seconds was shown in the Chinese version and the other got removed because Mark thought it was too ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I think it'll be very interesting to talk about that ratio, just to see the dynamics of power, just to identify who is the more powerful partner, who needs the relationship more. I think looking at these aspects can help.
Probably get quite complicated with the PO and various offsets and stuff. Measuring what exactly parts of the budget came under that and everything like that, and how that resulted in. But yeah, I'd like that idea.
Actually, looking at the figures itself could blow your brain apart because sometimes it doesn't match. The representation doesn't match. So I thought the easiest way for me was to look at location. Because looking at the financial figures was... not that it didn't make sense, it just didn't equal to what
was. I had to do quite a few equations to get... This is a different topic altogether, but like for the Great Gatsby.
Yeah.
Because the Americans tried to offset what they were paying for it. And so the budget was actually significantly higher than what was actually announced.
Yeah.
Because of they took out the PO.
Yeah.
And so you just got the PO-less budget, what America and the Australian producers put in.
Yeah.
And so it was complicated.
There's a lot of math involved, and if you email Screen Australia, they won't reply.
Yeah.
FYI. When I was trying to get the representation, they just ignored me.
I need more guanxi.
Yeah, you need more guanxi in both Australia and China.
Yes.
Okay. Did anyone have any more questions? Yeah.
I haven't seen any of these films, so this is coming from a point of ignorance. But do you think, I guess a lot of what you've been talking about is money, essentially, the funding of these films and the power that is given to both Australia and China forming these co-production alliances. But is there anything more than money to these connections? Is there a genuine kind of cultural exchange? Do the film benefit, do you think, from being co-productions in terms of narrative, form, themes, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I haven't done a textual analysis analysed Bait.
But you watched the international version.
Yes, the international version, not the Chinese added version. So I can't really say whether or not these films would ultimately be better if they weren't a co-production or not, or they were a co-production. I do think that there is a real industrial exchange that does work for both sides of the agreement, whether or not, and those creative and financial things, they're so interlinked, especially in film where it's so expensive that it is real.
I guess to a certain extent they couldn't be made unless that connection.
But whether or not, I think there's a question about the types of stories that they tell, which a lot of producers talked about their interests in how At Last and The Whistleblower go, because they're the two
different
ones that aren't about sharks or about spiders or
fantasy films or about China, really.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the same for the expectations were high for 33 Postcards and ones that give a little bit more weight.
But didn't do very well.
But, you know, that's film, right?
So there's 3 postcards about this orphan Chinese girl got adopted in Australia. So it's a very, it was supposed to be a human kind of touching story to cross boundaries for the 3 postcard. And I think that's the one they're trying to do for the other movies. But I think overall, fantasy movies has always
done well for Australia. Big returns.
Yeah.
The Paper Menagerie, I think it would be, if it actually progresses to the point of production and release, I think that would be quite a good one.
Mm.
The Paper Menagerie, the first green one.
Number nine.
Because it tells that story about a transnationally formed family.
Mm.
The relationship between a Western and China is in the story itself, and so that dynamic is part of it, and hopefully that comes out.
Do you know if the director is Chinese or Australian? Or
I don't think it's progressed to that point yet.
It's just in development.
Just in development.
One of the keys.
It hasn't even been announced.
One of the key indicator is who wrote the script.
Right.
I think a lot of this production, if I'm not mistaken, is written by Chinese because there was a pitch session last year.
Oh, you've heard?
And the year before. Don't remember the titles, but there's a few that I think I remember the stories. A lot of them are from Chinese side. Maybe one or two is from Australian side, but the Australian scriptwriter with a Chinese partner. A lot of them are Chinese living in Australia or studying in Australia. But majority of the co-productions are written by Australians.
All right.
Or Chinese Australians, but Australians nonetheless.
It's one of the... You want to say something?
I was going to follow on from Mel's question. I mean, this is going back a minute or two. But the differences between international versions versus Chinese versions. I mean, one of the things that really struck me, and you kind of put it out as like a fleeting point, you know, Ghostbusters.
Right.
And you know, the 14 minutes that was cut out of Logan.
Yeah.
I mean, these are films that are obviously they're heavily Hollywoodized, they're Americanized, but they seem to have no real links whatsoever to China or Chinese politics.
So they would be quota films.
Yeah.
But they would also have.
But why? I guess my question is, what's the difference between the international version and the edited Chinese version, and what's the justification for that?
Right. I think it's production specific.
Okay.
And so in Logan, it was China introduced the R rating, I think, for Logan.
Oh, did they?
Or not R rating as we.
So China has no sense. There's no rating in China.
No rating in China.
So everyone can watch every film.
Yeah, so they have to be careful because some for children, isn't that often? And Chinese audiences are very particularly young.
Okay.
So I read somewhere, 18 to 30, under 30 is the 80% of the population. So, if children, young families with children will go to see a blockbuster.
I see.
And so if it's too violent.
Right. So all that makes sense then with Deadpool just not getting released whatsoever.
Right, yeah. Well, I didn't hear any reasons why that was knocked back, other than it could have been just for the fact that they filled up their 34 quota and they weren't going to allow
anything. But do they care about the 34 quota?
No, they don't care. They do use that
as an excuse.
Yeah, it's an excuse. But yeah, no, I don't know about Deadpool, but obviously.
There's a difference too between international and Chinese. So you've got the Chinese censorship version, which is what Ben is talking about, and then you have the big international and Chinese version, which is what we were talking about, where you add scenes. So do you want to guess what other movies? Looper got additional scenes. Iron Man 3 got additional scenes. Do you know about Looper? Do you want to tell them about Looper? So the film was actually supposed to be set in Paris. You know, that's why Joseph Gordon-Levitt character loved French.
Right.
He always spoke in French. He loves French. But in the future, Bruce Willis lived in Shanghai.
Yeah.
The reason why is because they had to change the script after they got major financial investment from China. So if you watch Looper, the original version, the international version, his wife is not really shown. His wife is a Chinese actress, but in the Chinese version, she had dialogue and she was shown in the film. Did you watch the Chinese version of Iron Man 3?
No.
So in Iron Man 3, was it Tony Stark? He got injured in one scene and he looked like he was about to die in that scene. And so in the Chinese version, he got shipped off to China and the Chinese saved him and he managed to save the world. So that scene was cut off from the international version. So if you watch the international version, Iron Man 3 was seen as injured and then after that he recovered. In the Chinese version, there was the whole scene in between to show how he recovered. And they showed two very prominent actors, Chinese actors, in that scene, and they sold that in China as them being one of the main characters. For Bait 3D, it was similar. So the reason why the film did so well, because I did the audience analysis for this film, Chinese audience analysis, because Shi Xiaolong, which is very famous when he was young, he was like, if anyone watches any Chinese language show, he was like this little boy, he was always playing this monk, little monk character in those kung fu. This was his first international debut since he left acting when he was a kid. So they, in the film, in China marketing, they said that he was starring in the film. So if you look at the credit scene, his name was second on the credit scene, even though he only made less than 1 minute appearance in the Chinese version. So in the beginning, how they did the Chinese version was, they showed them in, so in Australian version, international version, started in Gold Coast. Chinese version, they started in Beijing with another Singaporean Chinese character. They were at a Beijing club and it just tried to build that romantic relationship between those two characters, whereas in the original version, there was no romantic relationship. So they actually filmed additional about 10 minutes, extra 10 minutes. So, but the Mark only put in the first few seconds in the beginning and he refused to put the others. Because the other scene shows Shi Xiaolong riding a motorbike to meet his girlfriend, giving his girlfriend a necklace, and then cut. And then the next scene was, because Bait is basically shark infested supermarket. They're all stuck in a supermarket. Shark tried to kill everyone. Shark killed all the Asian characters but left all the Australian characters alive. So how they want to improve on that scene was to get the Chinese international rescue team to come to Australia to rescue the Australians out of the supermarket. So that's where his character plays a role, but they removed that scene from the Chinese version, so because Mark felt that it was too much, it didn't fit with the story. So you have two different type of Chinese version. You have that where they actually have an impact on the narrative, and
which I guess
censorship version. Yeah. They say the Children of the Huang Shi, but Children of Huang Shi released all the same version, but they had to do quite a lot of
reshoot.
Yeah. It's like, you know, Mao Last Dancer? It didn't get official, it was stated to be official co-production, but it didn't get official co-production because I can't remember his name, but the ballet dancer, he lives in Australia now and he's very against the Communist Party, and they refused to change his story in the film. So the government rejected the film for official co-production.
But that's understandable. That's for political reasons. Yeah. Mao's Last Dance, even the name, because he went to America. He wanted to stay in America, and he was under pressure from the consulate or embassy. So there's no way it would be allowed. So in China, at all, to show someone that kind of story. But it's interesting to see the difference between international and local Chinese versions. It's from the point of view, it looks better, and also the audience feel more connection. The audience like to see Chinese doing great things and Chinese being part of the Hollywood, because they have a whole generation grow up with Hollywood blockbusters, and suddenly you have familiar Chinese faces in Chinese in Hollywood blockbusters and playing certain role, rather than there's a term called 打酱油, not just 打酱油, not just go there and buy some soy sauce, which means they just appear as faces. They have no dialogues and they're not playing any parts, making any contributions.
It absolutely makes sense.
Yeah.
More integrated into the
production.
But now this strategy is banned.
Which strategy?
The Chinese version strategy. So they can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. Since Transformers, they can't do it anymore.
What do you mean they can't
Because
they can't do a separate version.
That's right. They transform people.
Yeah.
Who stop it? Separate
the
version?
Chinese government. So you're not allowed to. So you're only allowed to have one version in the whole world. So my argument is that the Chinese government has power over Hollywood films because they dictate what the censorship is. So if the Chinese government says no, it's no, and Hollywood wants to break into this market, they can't do two versions anymore.
And what does that remind us of? Hollywood production value. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I keep thinking of that, actually.
It's the whole system is Hollywood, because it's all scripts before, X, Y, and Z, get approved before you get made. And now they're saying they're like the new legion of decency. It's like we can't.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. Maybe the government want to make sure the Chinese scenes short for Chinese audience is seen on the global stage.
Yeah, it's their second largest industry now in the world. So
2020.
If you want a Chinese market,
you can.
This
bingo.
Got to be it.
Yeah.
So do yep.
Can I ask? I mean, this is going way off topic, but I'm going to ask it anyway because I can, because I'm here.
That gives you the right.
Yeah, it gives me the right. I'm teaching, for God knows what reason, I'm teaching Baz Luhrmann's Australia this week in tutorials. I mean, I guess I have a kind of multi-pronged question, but it's going to start with was this released in China at all?
No.
It wasn't.
It wasn't? I wouldn't think so.
I have no idea.
A multi-pronged
question. I don't know. Do you know?
No, I don't know.
Okay.
But I wouldn't. Oh, it was a big production.
I can check for you later.
IMDb.
Okay.
Does it say IMDb?
It probably will say IMDb. I can check the Chinese.
Go to Box Office Mojo.
In China. Yeah, you should check on the Chinese website to be more sure.
Well, that's getting a bit too complicated.
No.
It's all happening right now. It's all
no, yeah, that's good.
I've opened a Pandora's box with this.
But I don't know. Nicole Kidman is very popular in China, so maybe it could be. I don't know.
Well,
Australia.
Too, so.
You being Australia or Great Gatsby?
Australia.
Yeah, the Baz Luhrmann.
Unlikely.
Yeah.
Great.
I mean, I'm just thinking, kind of, you know, I kind of commented earlier on the kind of propaganda-ish. Ideas behind some of this and certainly the kind of advertorial content of some of the co-productions that certainly I've seen. And I just wonder how that would fit into this kind of debate or not.
Well, I think that, yeah, you're saying that the way China shapes films is similar to ways that
the tourism Australia.
And
I mean, like clearly each nation, if they're involved in a co-production, they have their own particular agenda to it. And I think that this would be, I mean, basically the film Australia was essentially kind of underwritten by the Tourism Australia department. Like it was a propaganda piece, essentially. And I'm just wondering, I don't know if I necessarily have a question here. It's more just it's something that came up in kind of my tutorials today, and I presume it will come up repeatedly throughout the week. But
Luke said it was released in China.
It was
just less than 2.5 million gross.
Wow. Okay. So it was
really?
Basically a failure.
Australia was.
Yeah.
Australia was
released. Yeah. Based on 20 million, 2.5 million.
So like your home territory saw it, and that's the extent.
The opening weekend was 817,000.
Because it's not a co-production. Part of the 34th film.
It must have maybe
it was
in Beijing or
maybe
Shanghai
it was limited.
Or something.
I wonder how that even got through the kind of censorship.
Probably because of Nicole Kidman.
What was the box office
maybe.
In China?
And Hugh Jackman.
It was
I think maybe Star Power.
2.4 million.
It's pretty.
That's
about.
Not, that wouldn't
so
be much.
That's pretty pathetic.
China.
Yeah. It's pretty pathetic.
But it was pretty. It was because actually, like Germany got 16 million.
Yeah, right.
It only came out 3 months after it did in Australia, so it's pretty.
I have a question.
Interesting.
What was the when you talk to industry people, what was your senses of their general feeling sentiment towards China, Australia China co-production? Is it a more frustration or is it frustration but great hope and what was, you know, where things are, because in the early years, in the early days, and people were very excited about the treaty and about the prospect, future prospect of making millions. And I just wonder, after some years, after some, you know, more films being produced and shelved and released and more experience, what is, you know, what is your all? It might vary. Some are still optimistic.
Yeah, some people are jaded.
Yeah.
They're very jaded by it. And
those who have tried and failed.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they've been burnt by it, I guess. They, people put a lot of energy in and they don't get anything back from it.
Yeah.
But I speak to Mark Lazarus, and the two primaries from China Line, Mark and Genevieve Chang, who's now at Screen Australia, they were super optimistic and very engaged in trying to work all of this out, trying to make it work. So it varies. People are very jaded to people like Mark and Genevieve, who are optimistic that it will come good, and yeah, they'll keep on trying for sure.
Yeah, Mark is understandable because he worked on Bait, which was a big hit. And what about Genevieve?
She has her family comes from China, and so I think there's a cultural background to her wanting it to work, but also I think her personality is such that she's optimistic,
yes,
and
no matter what
wants to help Australia become a little bit more international and maybe rub off some of the harder edges of Australian representations of China and things like that.
Okay. Is she Australian Chinese?
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
She grew up here.
She grew up here, and her family, it's very complicated. Well, around 1950s, her family moved to Taiwan.
Oh, yeah.
And then her family then moved from Taiwan to Australia.
Oh, okay.
But she still had family in China.
Does anyone have any last questions?
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
I learned a lot from you, so thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. You can follow us on Twitter @_SSSnetwork, like us on Facebook @Sydney Screen Studies, and visit us at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.